Do you invest in ETFs? Whether you're thinking, what in the world is an ETF? Or you're looking for the next opportunity to add to your portfolio. GlobalX has you covered. From big tech to bonds and bars of gold, GlobalX offers a wide range of exchange-traded funds. Go beyond ordinary with GlobalX ETFs. Visit globalxetfs.com.au. That's globalxetfs.com.au.
InvestSmart's portfolios are turning 10. And to celebrate, 10 InvestSmart boot camps are up for grabs. This self-paced online course is ideal for both seasoned investors and those who are just starting out. Valued at $99, you could win a spot on this highly rated course. To enter the competition and for terms and conditions, simply visit investsmart.com.au/win. Don't miss out on this chance to learn from experts and take your investing to the next level. Simply visit investsmart.com.au/win. Good luck.
Hey there, here's a quick note. This podcast contains general financial advice only. That means it's not specific to you, your needs, goals, or objectives, so don't act on the information until you've spoken with your financial advisor. You'll find our full disclosure, disclaimer, and link to our financial services guide in the show notes.
Drew, welcome to this very special episode of the Australian Investors Podcast.
We always do the exciting stuff in the lead up to Christmas, don't we?
When we're most busy. Yeah. Yes, we do indeed. Bill Mitchell, how are you doing?
Very well, thank you.
It's good to have you in the studio.
Thanks for having me. Very happy
to be
here.
We've shared a lot of emails to get Bill in this week, haven't we? It was almost a year in the waiting.
Well, it's been a tricky period, eh?
Yeah. Bill, for folks that maybe aren't familiar with your role or how you spend your days now, we know that you were in Japan recently and you spend a lot of time there. Can you tell us, just fill us in, like the kind of the elevator pitch, what do you do today? How do you spend your time?
In front of a computer.
And behind a bass guitar.
Electric guitar, six string. Well, I mean, I'm a professor of economics and I have appointments at University of Newcastle. I've been there for many years. I also have a position called Docent Professor of Global Political Economy at University of Helsinki, where I'm about to go to. Hmm. So I go there every year for a little while. And I also have a guest professor position at Kyoto University, where I spend 2 to 3 months a year.
Hmm. Is there something in common between those three cities? Is there, they all seem quite progressive, maybe policy-wise? Maybe not.
I don't think Newcastle's very progressive anymore. Newcastle's been taken over by property developers and and dubious decisions by local government. Helsinki is the progressive city in Europe.
Yeah.
It's an interesting city because, from my end, I've written a lot of, the reason I got that job was because I've written a lot about Europe. Obviously, I've studied Europe. I've written books about it and spent a lot of time in Europe. From my perspective, I see golden arches there. You know, it's just laid on with public infrastructure, et cetera. But they tell me that they're suffering under austerity. And and so, you know, it's all relative, isn't it? The shift over the last, since they joined the Eurozone, has been significantly negative for them. I can't see it as much as I can. And Kyoto is, it's the old capital and, people talk about Kyoto culture and Osaka culture, the Kansian culture. And I even speak dialect now. It's it's ridiculous. I was in Tokyo the other day doing a TV program and this guy said to me, where'd you pick up all that dialect? And so, you know, I didn't even know I was using.
How long have you been professor or docent professor there?
Where?
In Kyoto?
A few years.
Oh, that was Helsinki, yeah.
Yeah, Helsinki, yeah. I've been there several years, Kyoto a few years, and I've got a really good relationship there. The guy that sort of attracted me there was Shinzo Abe's chief.
Abenomics. Oh,
his chief advisor. And he fell out with the Liberal Democratic government, Shinzo Abe's government, and quit. went back to his job at Kyoto over sales tax increases. So every now and then the Japanese government gets a bit paranoid about the size of their deficit. And American-trained PhD economists tell them they've got to cut back, and so they put up the sales tax. That's their big austerity move. And every time they put up the sales tax, boom, 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 there's a GDP collapses.
Yeah.
And it's a very interesting phenomenon, because, say, if you look at what happened in Australia when we introduced the GST in 2000, there was no significant downturn in household consumption, even though there was a 10% hike.
So a jump in prices and everything continued on.
Yeah. But in Japan, when they put it up 2%, there's a major collapse in household spending. And the difference is that Australians in that period went wild with their credit cards. You know, we went from, 65% household debt to disposable income to, what is it now, 195 or something.
This is Costello era, wasn't it?
Yeah. The Japanese households will not borrow.
Even though rates are so low?
No. It's just a culture. It's sort of the same culture my parents had in the 1950s and 60s, you know, that you don't borrow.
Don't spend beyond your means. Prices are going to be the same next week, why would you bring forward your purchase? Yeah.
I mean, my old man used to say, if you can't pay cash, you don't have it. That was that era. And the Japanese are still, I won't use the word stuck, they're still in that type of approach, which I think is more sensible. And
so much of ours are driven by speculation, isn't it? That property in particular will always go up, or shares will go up 10% every year. Or
And a sort of false optimism. I think that Australia, countries like Australia, are always on the precipice of major disaster if casual working hours, because we've got a lot of dependency on the second money winner, typically the woman, getting casual hours. And if those casual hours disappear, you have people out at Cranbourne with the big houses and the big boats there. They go from having that semblance of wealth to bankruptcy.
Yeah.
Very quickly.
And that's been the change in Australia over the last 30 years. You've got that sort of real precipice that looks like wealth, looks like security, and it'll just vanish.
All the leverage that's embedded in the household budgets.
That's the point. And the leverage is dependent on things that are sensitive to economic change, like casual hours. That's the point.
And when did you start reading Bill's work? Was it when I annoyed you with?
No, it would have been years ago. I think it was when everyone, like the debt ceiling just kept being brought
18,
up in
19,
yeah,
20,
probably a little bit earlier. And I remember seeing interviews with Warren as well. And
Mosler.
And the Bloomberg interviews repeated about, you know, QE, how is it sustainable? And I just needed to discover more.
And none of it made sense. Why is what they're saying is supposed to happen not happening?
Yeah, everyone's,
and you hear that a lot, Bill.
I had someone come up to me at an event the other day and they said, you know, the whole system's rigged. It's going to explode. You've seen the debt levels. And I'm just thinking, this doesn't make sense.
Money printing is inflationary.
After years of no inflation.
Yeah.
So I just couldn't reconcile it, because I'd very baseline level of economics at school, to be sure, even though I studied finance. But I couldn't reconcile that. So maybe this is actually just a really good segue. We just can talk generally how you introduce the topic of MMT. Imagine that you're talking to someone, as we mentioned off air, that's not necessarily a trained economist, hasn't been to finance school. How do you explain the principles and how you came to it?
Well, that's a separate question to what it is.
Yep.
I mean, I came to it when I was sitting one day, in as much as you can point to an event. I was sitting one day in the middle of winter in Melbourne University. I was doing my fourth year. you had to do 6 units or something plus a thesis, and I was, one of my units was agricultural economics. And it was a very cold day, and those lecture theatres used to be really freezing.
I told you he was a good storyteller.
Used to be really freezing, and the topic of the lecture that day was the wool price stabilisation scheme. And that was a scheme the Australian government ran under pressure from the rural lobby to stabilise incomes for sheep wool producers, because they were previous to that boom and bust, you know. They'd get
the market force.
Yeah, they'd get the Merc 1 year, and then they'd have to sell it next year or go into bigger debt. And so the government agreed that they would intervene in the market. To stabilise the price, to stabilise incomes. And what that meant was that they would buy, if there was excess supply of wool into the market on any particular auction, which would, if the market was left, it would drive the price down, the government would buy that up.
Sounds familiar.
Yeah, and if there was an excess demand, the government would sell it. And so all around our capital cities were those big old red brick buildings, which are now gentrified apartment blocks.
Very expensive.
Fitzroy, probably, and Richmond,
yeah. Abbotsford, down there. There's all those old big multi-storey brick buildings. Mm. Well, they were the wool stores, and that's where the government used to store the wool, and they'd buy and sell out of that. And, you know, I wasn't so much interested, and this was late 1970s when unemployment had started to rise, and the mainstream of my profession was saying, oh, there's nothing the government can do about it. It was this beginning of sort of what we started to call in those days economic rationalism, which has broadened into sort of neoliberalism.
It's like Keynesian or not.
What's that?
Not Keynesian.
No, Keynesian. Keynesian economics had been abandoned then. Yeah. So we had, that was that era. Unemployment was rising. I was a progressive thinker, I thought, on the left of the spectrum, and I wanted to come up with ideas that could, and inflation was high because it was around the first OPEC oil crisis shock in October 73 had massive effects. And then the second one came along around about that time, late 70s. So I wanted to work out how you could deal with inflation but not create unemployment. That was on my mind constantly.
Well, it doesn't make sense. There has to be a trade-off, does there?
Why? Well, the mainstream paradigm was that there had to be a trade-off, you had to – that was the beginning of – that was the period where we abandoned the concept that the government would create full employment. That's when we went to inflation first. We had to deal with inflation, and unemployment would be the a policy tool rather than a policy target. Because up until then, the target was that, you know, the unemployment had to stay below 2%, and federal government would be in danger of losing office if it went above 2%. You know, 1961 election, Robert Menzies nearly lost the one by one seat because unemployment was 2.1%. Was during the credit squeeze in 1961. Anyway, back to the story.
I see the parallel. It's a very good parallel. Yeah, well, it makes complete sense.
Back to the story. So I wasn't so much interested in wool. I was much more interested in unemployment. And so the wool, what I conceived from the wool price stabilisation scheme, that the government could, through its spending decisions, set a price.
For anything.
For whatever. Just about. And so it could, and the model that I had in my mind was it could set a price for labour. In other words, control inflationary spirals coming from the labour market. If it ran a wool price stabilisation scheme for workers. In other words, when there's an excess supply, that's when the private sector's laying off workers. The government could buy those at a fixed price. And when the private sector was starting to expand again, they could just start, because the fixed price would be below the wage structure in the private sector, the private sector employers could easily bid them back again. And so if you think about it, if you've got in an inflationary period and you've got one buyer buying at a fixed price, well, then that's ultimately going to reduce the inflationary pressures.
Mm.
And in other words, I accepted that the government had to tighten policy when there was inflation, but instead of creating unemployment, they could create employment at a fixed price and transfer workers from an inflating sector to a fixed price sector. So that was the start in my thinking that, and I it was quite clear to me that after August 1971, when we got off the fixed exchange rate system, the Bretton Woods system, we didn't get off it until the mid-80s, but it was mostly a light managed float up until the mid-80s from the early 70s. And it was quite clear to me that the government really, the stuff we were learning in economics about the government being financially constrained was just complete garbage. How could it be financially constrained when you open your wallet and it was their money? It wasn't my
money. Printing it.
It wasn't my money. Well, you know, were they printing it?
Minting it.
They were, well, subsequent inquiry knows that they type numbers into bank accounts. But,
that's the next step.
But yeah, that came later, but it was quite clear that it was their money, not my money. And so when politicians would go start raving on about taxpayers this and taxpayers that, well, it was quite clear to me that taxpayers didn't fund anything.
We blame Thatcher for that? That was more recent? Or the more recent policy austerity?
See, I really blame the British Labor Party for that. The Callaghan period, Dennis Healey was the Chancellor.
It was like comparisons of a government balance sheet to a normal balance sheet.
Household balance sheet, yeah. And this idea that, you know, the government that issues its own currency could not have it. How could that be? Now, all the stuff about the banking of MMT, that came later with Warren because that was his ballpark.
But
it was clear to me that the government wasn't financially constrained, and it was clear to me that that it could set a price through its buying program, depending on how they designed that.
So the question is, like, always, like, if we go to our bank accounts, if we log into NAB or something, and we look at it and we can see, unless we go into a deficit, like unless we go into credit, we have a fixed amount of money that we can spend as a household budget. But the government, it prints the money, or not prints, but adds the numbers to the bank account. So in theory, it could stimulate if it wanted to. Would it be fair to say almost unlimited capacity to stimulate?
Well, you saw it during the pandemic where apparently we couldn't spend an extra $5 billion a year, but we could spend $100 billion in 3 weeks.
Yeah.
I answered the question for you.
Well, I mean, Jimi Hendrix in Voodoo Child talks about the outskirts of infinity.
Yeah.
And that's the financial capacity of government, outskirts of infinity. Infinity minus 1 cent. Given you can't get to infinity. And so once you cross that line and understand that, then obviously the question is, well, are there constraints on governments? And well, of course there are. They can buy whatever's for sale, but with their currency, but that's all. And if they try to compete in the market at market prices for resources that are not available, that are currently being used, well, then there will be inflationary pressures from the demand side. That's obvious. And once you understand that, then you start to say, okay, well, how does it garner resources if they're already fully used? Well, then you.
So the government creates inflation.
Well, all spending creates inflationary risk.
Yeah.
All spending, whether it's household spending, whether it's business investment, whether it's exported greater than imports, or whether it's government spending, it's all.
Because you're bidding for the same resource or the scarce resources.
You're bidding at market prices for a resource that might be already used.
That's why the OECD came out and said the fiscal spend on infrastructure is kind of crowding out the private sector, whether that's housing construction on the other side?
Well, that crowding out in the real resource sense, not the financial sense, in the real resource sense. And so then once you get to that point, then the next step is very exciting because you say, well, how can the government actually resource itself? In other words, have a public sector. How does it do that without creating inflation? Well, it does it by depriving us, the non-government sector, of the use of those resources. How does it do that? Well, it's got to create unemployed resources. How does it do that? Taxation. Tax. Because taxation reduces our disposable income, which means that we can't buy as many resource access to resource uses we might if we had zero taxation. And what are those resources going to do? Well, they're going to sit idle unless they're brought back into productive use through government spending.
Is that why we put in like mineral resources rent tax, or is that more?
Well, in modern monetary theory, obviously, we embrace some of the uses of purposes of
super
taxation.
Super profits,
Of mainstream. I mean, obviously, taxation can be an allocative measure. So if you want to shift out resource usage, in other words, you don't want people to be smoking or drinking too much, or you don't want them to be using carbon as much. So that's a purpose of taxes. But the other purpose of tax is to free up resources so that the public sector can resource itself. It's got nothing to do with providing the public sector with the cash in which it needs to spend, because it's got infinity minus one. It's to stop us spending. Now, once you've crossed that line, then you're into MMT world, and you've got a totally different perspective on the world.
My future employer, I think, too. Comes into question.
What's that?
The RBA. We joke about becoming a future board member of the RBA.
Yeah.
But that's where the monetary side of MMT comes in.
Yeah, you've got a totally different perception of what the constraints on government are. The constraints on government are real resources, not financial resources. Yeah. So then you, in the sort of political sphere, the sort of questions that we should be asking our politicians would change if you've got an MMT understanding. Because when a politician says, oh, we can't afford to, unemployment's a market phenomenon, we can't afford to provide jobs, well, you know then the politician's not being truthful. Of course they can. They just don't want to. So unemployment becomes a political choice, not a financial necessity.
Are there people in Australia that understand it, you think, in government, but whether they're able to
execute it? I think there are some. And, I mean, I talked to...
Was it Guy Debelle studied under you?
I taught Guy in fourth year when I taught in Adelaide. Guy, I would say, definitely understands it. He was a very bright chap and a great loss to the policy sector, I think. But, I talked to some politicians and...
I think you've said that you can't be seen with politicians of either side when we've chatted either.
Yeah.
They don't want to be seen with you.
Yeah. And the ones that are the one the couple of politicians that understand the most are on the Liberal side.
Yeah,
funny enough.
So, Bill, my question is: my understanding has always been that we would effectively entrust the government to exercise judgment of where there is capacity, where there is supply, and balance accordingly. Because if you think, I heard an interview that you did like 8 years ago. I was listening to it on the way in this morning. In which you talked about basically the idea of people being out of a job it's devastating for families, it's devastating for households, and economic theory and execution should be built around this idea that people can remain employed and they can think positively towards the future, remain productive members of society, right? But I guess if we shift to trusting the government with making these decisions of where taxes are applied and where decisions are made to stimulate, do we need a different institution within our government to exercise that judgment? Because at the moment we've got fiscal and monetary policy. Do we need a third element to do that, or is the would a government, say in Australia, be equipped to do that?
Is the election cycle too short?
Yeah, that's what I mean, because they would optimise for the next 4 years.
That's
right?
A constraint, right there.
Well, I mean, that's one of the arguments that the Conservatives use to do what I call depoliticise economic policy. So that's one of the reasons why they rave on about central bank independence, that you push off monetary policy to an unelected, unaccountable body.
That determines the cost of capital for every business person and household in the world,
and can devastate low-income mortgage holders like they are now with, 11 increases, 52% increase in average home mortgage monthly mortgage payments.
But a cut coming.
Don't listen to him.
I think it's...
Bill agrees with me, trust me.
I think a cut is coming.
See?
What goes up goes down.
but you say enough times, you're eventually right. We know this about economists.
That's right.
No offence.
That can depoliticisation is very convenient for guys like Jim Chalmers, because he can then say, well, it's not us doing it to you, sorry.
Yeah, and we can keep the trigger on fiscal policy on one side if they're pushing monetary on the other
side. And Jim Chalmers can say, oh, well, they'll push up interest rates if we do too much and it's their fault, we'll have to cut back. Look, I share the scepticism that people have about the quality of our political class. I think that over the years we've transitioned from people that were really dedicated to public service to careerists.
And so from policy to almost a profession.
Yeah, careerists who are concerned with power rather than public service.
Mm.
And that's a real problem for our democracy, I think. I think that the 24-hour news cycle, the controversies are really damaging to our national estate. And so, yeah, I accept all of that. But it's all we've got. You've got to have a fiscal authority. You've got to have a monetary authority.
Mm.
Now, I think it should be merged. I don't think we should have a separate central bank, because I think monetary policy as practiced is pretty ineffective.
Mm.
And it's...
We've seen that, haven't we? They've been targeting inflation and they've increased rates 11 times and inflation has still naturally slowed.
Well, I mean, the other thing that most people don't really...
It's actually reallocating wealth to retire people with capital away from people.
There's been a historic redistribution of wealth from low income and low wealth to high income and high wealth.
Yeah.
Lots of capital.
Yeah, lots of inequality.
Yeah. An almost obscene redistribution. But what most people don't understand is that the way monetary policy isn't clearly – interest rate rises aren't clearly anti-inflationary.
That's it. We don't know if it's a gas pedal or a brake pedal, right?
Well, I'm on the petrol pedal, the gas pedal. I think you can see what's driving the CPI at the moment. Well, rents. Well, why are rents going up? Yeah, there's a shortage of housing, and that reflects a poor investment decisions over many years of state and federal governments in social housing particularly. But given that, rising interest rates, you're going to predict always that rents are going to go up because the landlords are going to pass them on.
Mm.
Yeah.
And so you get interest rate rises are actually inflationary. And moreover, the impact on businesses with overdrafts for their working capital, 30-day credit type arrangements with their suppliers, well, anyone who's got price setting power is going to pass on those interest rate payments.
Mm.
So it's unclear that the interest rate rises and the whole conduct of monetary policy is actually fit for its purpose. That's the so I would just forget that. And fiscal policy is much more direct and much more fit for counter-stabilising spending fluctuations. Now, the question then is, well, who decides fiscal policy? Well, that's the problem, that I don't think, you know, these fiscal boards that have emerged in Europe and you know, Chalmers would love to have one here where you fill a room up with mainstream economists to determine fiscal policy. Well, that's not going to work, in my view, to advance societal well-being, because mainstream economics is not fit for purpose.
They'll come to a consensus pretty quickly.
They'll come to some
annualised rates.
They'll come to a consensus immediately, and because of the homogeneity of the debate, and that's the problem. And so, you know, I think the challenge for citizens is that we've got to improve our political class, and well, the only way you really can do that is to get involved in branch politics and local community organisations, and in a way, the Teals are a reflection in Australia of that sort of way in which community pressure. Beginning with climate issues, that's the Teals were all
quite narrow. Yeah,
that's what motivated their rise. But that's the only way we're going to improve the political class.
So we've constantly got this question that pops up, even in our Q&A every week, which is that the US government's going to default, or the Australian government's going to default. Like, well, how do we have however many trillion? I don't even want to see the number in the US. And I know in Stephanie Carlton's book, she talked about how politicians tend to use every single digit of a number when they're putting it into something because it scares people and it helps them make harsh decisions. But you're saying governments can't default, or
if they issue their own currencies,
those governments will never default, and never.
So buy? No, that's not a buy. No, not investment advice.
We'll never default, and. It's just a reflection of the stupidity of the commentator who ever raises that question. Of course, you know, most of the commentators that do raise that question know damn well that they won't default. They're just using it as a scare tactic to advance their own agendas, because they know that people out in real world land aren't very well versed in economics, unfortunately, and get scared easily because it sounds catastrophic. It will never happen. It can't happen. I mean,
is that the connection to the wool sheds, central bank policy,
or is it the gold standard?
What's a gold?
So you know how we had gold as the currency because we only had a finite supply in theory.
Yeah, which blew up. Yeah,
yeah.
Well, gold was never the gold standard. Gold wasn't the currency. I mean, if you're talking about the Bretton Woods system after the Second World War, the system was that they believed that the world had found all the gold.
Exactly.
So they thought that gold was going to be relatively stable in supply. So they set the US dollar against, calibrated that $30 US dollars an ounce of gold. And then they set all the other currencies against the US dollar. That was the Bretton Woods system. The problem was it was totally unsustainable.
Mm.
You could never go back to that. But why are you talking about that?
Well, just in terms
of pivoting the other way around the kind of buyer of a last resort, essentially, where people don't necessarily, you talk about the RBA not being independent, and most people, as you said, don't understand that. How is the RBA not independent, and how does the government keep issuing bonds? Who's going to buy them if we've got so much debt?
Well, they don't even need to issue bonds. That's the next step in our progress towards intellectual honesty. The government could just stop issuing.
Because we've got the Treasury Department that sits between. Yeah.
Well, the bond are issued by the Australian Office of Financial Management, which is a division of Treasury.
Yeah.
Look, people should realise that the government doesn't have to issue debt. The debt doesn't finance the government spending. That the government spends every hour of the business day instructing the Department of Treasury tells Finance what's got to be procured. Department of Finance tells the Central Bank, Reserve Bank, type some numbers in, please.
Here they come.
And zonk, there they go. And if the typist put in an extra zero, well, government spending would be an extra zero bigger, which might be quite large. But it wouldn't matter.
And this is why what happened during the pandemic and through every crisis since.
Yeah.
And at the bottom, at the essentially the bottom, and the market stopped falling when the central bank stepped in.
Yeah, I mean, what,
in different ways.
During the pandemic, the Reserve Bank of Australia bought 95% of state and territory and federal government debt. Bang.
Mm.
In other words, government buying its own debt. The Reserve Bank's part of government. It's not separate from government. So it's, and you know, you get, you have this sort of almost like a, you know, you could write a pantomime about it, where the
right, we're living in a pantomime.
The right pocket of government gives a bond to the left pocket of government. The left pocket of government types in some numbers, and then when the dividend, when the yields have got to be paid each period, the left pocket gives the right pocket some some yields. I'm getting confused which pocket's which. And then, of course, when they've got to be paid,
he's wearing cargo pants.
When the debt's got to be paid back, the pockets swap money again. I mean, it's just nonsensical.
And but this is where I was going before: is people think there's a finite supply of something. They think it has to be anchored to something, but it doesn't. No, it's like that pocket's that pocket goes on for infinity, right?
Minus one.
And so people liken the
outskirts of infinity.
Yeah, outskirts minus one. People think that there is a finite supply, so we can't just keep increasing distance. And that's where the politicization of it comes from, because people don't understand that very basic principle.
You know, one analogy I use is, imagine now we're in Victoria today, Melbourne, so it's a football town. A proper football team. Go the D's. Go the D's. Imagine, you know, 3 minutes into the third quarter, there's an announcement over the PA system. The game has to stop. The scoreboard's run out of points.
I've heard this one before. Yeah. I like this one.
Imagine that.
Yeah.
Scoreboard's run. The MCG scoreboard, we haven't got any more points to put. The game's got to stop. Now, people are going to be walking along after the game desolate because the D's were up beating Collingwood by about 40 points and going, God, why didn't they allocate more points? Why didn't they, you know, why didn't they save up some points?
It's a digital scoreboard.
Yeah. And of course,
it doesn't make sense.
Of course, then no, it's just absurd that they type numbers on into the scoreboard, or they used to put them up.
Yeah, even then they didn't run out.
Well, they can't run out. And it's like the tram system suddenly announcing over all the booths, we've run out of tickets today. Now, they might run out of capacity to hold people in the trams, but they can't ever run out of tickets.
Mm.
And the government might run out of capacity of real resources to buy, but it can never run out of dollars, ever. Can type as many as they like. And I mean, during the pandemic, during the GFC, we should have realised it. You know, trillions of dollars were spent in America, just bang, to save the whole financial system. Bang, it just went out.
Mm. Then we talked about 10 years of QE and the problems that caused is what people talked about, not saying that it did.
Well, they don't even understand what QE is.
Yeah.
Mm.
That's the problem of QE. They thought it was giving the banks money to lend. The banks don't need money to lend.
Mm.
The banks don't lend their reserves. The reserves never get lent out unless they lend them overnight on the interbank market. But
mm.
And why does Japan stand out so much? I know you've done a lot of work there.
Well, I mean, as I said to you off the camera, we've had this very economists hanker for in experiments. Because unlike the physical sciences, we don't have control over our research. In a sense, we don't have control groups that we can benchmark off. And so the beauty of the current period, which you really shouldn't talk about beauty in terms of what the Reserve Bank's been doing, that's ugly. But we've had an experiment in the world over the last 2 years. So when the Federal Reserve started in America, started raising interest rates, all the other central banks went lockstep like morons and started to push up interest rates. The Bank of Japan hasn't changed its negative rate at all. Not at all. And if you read, you know, even yesterday they put out a statement on monetary policy where they reaffirmed their view that inflation's coming down. It was always driven by supply factors that interest rates weren't able to really get to. So, you know, how did pushing up interest rates make people less sick from COVID so they could work harder and supply more goods and services? How did they get the ships back into the right ports? How did they stop Putin in Ukraine? How did interest rate rises stop OPEC profit gouging by withdrawing supply? Well, clearly they didn't. Interest rates were not the right tool to deal with the inflationary pressures. And, you know, in 2021, I went out on a limb, as I mostly do, and I predicted this inflation would be relatively short-lived. It was nothing like the 1970s inflation.
Transitory. Not necessarily transitory, just a matter of time.
No, I use the word transitory, but I was careful to say that transitory doesn't necessarily mean
6 months or 12 months.
Have a time dimension to it. It just means that the impulse factors were going to abate.
It wasn't a secular, it was a cyclical.
Mm. Yeah. You weren't going to get any secondary propagation things like we had in the 70s with the wage price pressures.
Mm.
The Bank of Japan's run the course. The financial markets have probably lost quite a bit of money betting against the Japanese government bond. You know, the so-called short selling of the 10-year bond, because they predicted that the bank would relent and follow suit and push up rates, which would push up yields in the bond market, which would push down prices. And so if they went short, they could make money. They've lost. They consistently lose. And you know, I reckon it'd be really I know people in the Bank of Japan, I reckon they would have a really enjoyable job because there's non-pecuniary aspects laughing at these fools in the financial markets who think that they know better than the bank and can outbid the bank, but they can't.
Mm. Bill, this is a great foray into a topic that you've been exploring for so many years. We'll include a heap of resources in the podcast to learn more about you. To get your books, I should say, the macroeconomics book that you've put out, which you co-authored, it's available as links on your website as well.
Yeah.
Blog, so much that you do. We really do appreciate you taking some time to share this with us. I remember a few years ago when we first started talking about MMT, I'm like, who can I get in? And I'm just so glad that we can finally have a chance to meet in person.
Well, one of the founders is in Australia.
Exactly, that doesn't help.
Absolutely. So once again, thanks for chatting with Drew and I.
More than welcome. Thank you. Thanks, care. Bill.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. Before you go, I wanted to share some things with you. Specifically, I wanted to tell you about the 10 ways that Rask could help you in 2024. As many of you know, Rask has grown to become one of the biggest investing and finance platforms in Australia. Across our podcasts, our websites, our memberships, and so on, we now engage around 200,000 Aussies. Which, considering we started in a humble lounge room on a Kmart desk, one of those old fake white wooden ones, I'm pretty ecstatic about where we are 6 years later. As part of becoming one of Australia's biggest platforms for wealth creation and preservation, we now have a very special position in the country in that we can bring you some of the best
most thoughtful, expert-driven ways to protect and grow your wealth. And I'm going to share some of those with you now. I've got 10 ways that we can potentially help you or match you with someone who can. The first thing that I want to tell you about is the biggest step we've ever taken at Rask, which is the launch of our Rask Invest platform. This is a platform that lets our team, led by me, invest for you, primarily through low-cost, diversified ETFs. We'll have three strategies at launch, and every investor who comes through can pick one of the three strategies, being a balanced strategy, a growth strategy, and a high-growth strategy. The balanced strategy focuses on passive income, and the high-growth strategy focuses on longer-term compounding. You will find a link in your podcast player to register your interest. We will be taking off soon. Number two, if you prefer to DIY your investing, you can join me and over 4,000 members inside Rask Core. That's our full ETF and ASX share research membership community. You can join now and you'll get updated ETF portfolio recommendations every quarter, as well as ongoing ASX and global stock research. Every single month, we call them the All-Star Stocks. You get that alongside the ETF portfolios, as well as other members-only content. It's called Rask Core. Number three, our first ever partnership with a business other than our own was a business by the name of Blusk, which has since become Flint Group. Flint Group is led by Chris Bates and Christian Stevens, two of Australia's most highly regarded mortgage brokers. Already over 200 Rask community members have begun the Rask plus Flint Group mortgage broking process. You can click the link in your podcast player if you're refinancing, investing, a first home buyer, or whatever. You've probably heard Chris on the show many times. Number four, you can connect with our most trusted financial advisors. Whether you're 25 years old, just graduated uni and looking to set yourself up, or approaching or in retirement and you've got that nest egg you want to protect and generate a passive income from, you can get in contact with our trusted panel of financial advisors. You can find the link in your podcast player. It's there each and every week. Just click the thing that says financial planning. Number five, if you want specialist insurance advice, as Warren Buffett said, rule number one is don't lose money. And rule number two is don't forget rule number one. Insurance is vitally important, especially when it comes to your number one asset, you. Whether you're a single income household or a couple, and you just want to protect what would happen if. You want to protect your family if something goes wrong. You want to protect your spouse if you lose your job. You want to protect yourself if you hurt yourself on the weekend at footy. Insurance is a way to do that. And I think the best way to do insurance is through a financial planner. And there's a few reasons for that, but one of them is sometimes some insurers will only work with financial advisors, but they can also be your companion as you go through the sometimes daunting process of getting insurance done properly. Sometimes you might not even know, but you're not even covered, even though you think you are. So get the right advice. You'll find a link in the show notes to check that out. Number six, buying property. If you're like me and you're thinking of buying property in the next 12 months, or maybe you've already invested and you're looking to downsize, getting the right advice and being able to build wealth through property is a proven strategy. It might be one of the most contentious, but I think that we have one of Australia's best property coaches in our ranks. That is Pete Wargent. Pete is the host of the now super popular Australian property podcast by Rask, and he's also my analyst team's macro consultant. So if you're a member of Rask Core, you will have seen Pete's name around the traps. He's a property coach and buyer's agent, and he works with a select number of people each and every year. Just a note on this, this is not a commercial thing with Pete. Pete just has great services, so we offer them to the community. And when he fills up, he fills up. You can find out more about Pete's coaching in the show notes. Next up, tracking your portfolio for tax. I think you are, because I think you have to. So we've partnered with Nivexa to help you manage your share and ETF reporting, whether it's tax or performance. All Rask users get 20% off an annual plan with Nivexa. You can sync your portfolio with Nivexa's software and it automatically tracks your dividends, your capital gains tax, and more. Again, not a commercial partnership. We don't make anything from working with Nivexa, but they do create some great tools which the Rask community uses each and every day.
Number 8. Want to run your own business? Maybe you already do. If you want more profit, but less stress, less time consumed, and less energy lost, get in contact. We have a partner business called Inflection. The Inflection Accelerator Program is a complete online course that helps you and a community of members engage and follow a proven strategy for growing your business. I'm grateful to be one of the coaches inside the Accelerator Program, helping business owners right across Australia. You can find more following the link in your podcast player. It's the one that says coaching. Number 9, if you haven't already checked it out, join over 20,000 other people who tune into the Rask YouTube channel. It is completely free and you get notified when we go live and when we publish podcast episodes. There is a podcast on the Rask network each and every day, as well as bite-sized material that's less than 60 seconds, or those really punchy tutorials and webinars that are just 15 minutes that take you through a really exciting topic, whether it's how to buy a property, whether it's how to pick a dividend ETF. Some of our most popular content actually just explains things like, what the heck is franking credits and how do I calculate if I've got some? That's on our YouTube channel. Number 10, if you want to be a better investor, a saver, a better partner with money, or just understand your own relationship with money, you can do that. All of that by going to the Rask Education website and taking a free course. We've enrolled over 26,000 students at the time of this recording, and we are on a mission to get to 100,000 in the next few years. Rask Education is our mostly free education platform, covering everything from budgeting and automation to the probably, I would say, the best value investing program in the country. So whether you're a value investor, an intermediate investor, you want to know how to value Woolworths shares, or you simply just want to understand what ethical investing is, or buy your first property and what actually happens on settlement day, head to the Rask Education website and enroll in something today. It is free and it supports us, because then I can come on here next month and I can say we've got 27,000, and hopefully we reach critical mass where we can help more Australians manage their money better. Thank you for listening to this long-winded ad. If you want to get in contact with me, you know where to go. There's a link in your show notes. Basically, these 10 services, even though some of them we don't make any money from, support Rask and allow us to produce these podcasts, attract the biggest and best guests from Australia and around the world, and bring them to you to answer your questions. Thank you for being part of the Rask Network, and thank you for your ongoing support. Bye for now.